Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers. So glad you're here with us today. October 16th, 2011. Getting ready to wrap up this year, aren't we, pretty soon? Don't get the Christmas stuff out yet, though, okay? We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. The solar wind tonight is a blistering 436.3 kilometers per second, and the proton count is an average of 1.2 protons per cubic centimeter. Always interesting to hear those specs, I know, because it's just neat to know how we're being buffeted by the sun. The ROSAT X-ray Observatory, launched in 1990 by NASA and managed for years by the German Aerospace Center DLR, will return to Earth within the next 2 weeks. It won't be a pretty thing. It's one of those unknown decays of an orbit. Best current estimates place the reentry between October 22nd and October 24th. That's either the day before or the day after next week's program. So I just wanted you to be aware that it's going to be coming down in an unknown part of the Earth. Okay, that's the part that we really want to pay attention to. Because although ROSAT is smaller and less massive than the UARS satellite, which ostensibly landed somewhere in the Pacific, which grabbed headlines when it reentered on September 24th, about a month ago, more of ROSAT could reach the planet's surface. And this is because the satellite observatory is made of heat-tolerant materials. That is to say, it will hold up in the reentry process. That's the scary part. We're just not quite sure how much of it's going to survive. According to a DLR study, as many as 30 individual pieces could survive the fires of reentry. The largest single fragment would likely be the telescope's mirror. Not a small thing. It's very heat resistant, and it may weigh as much as 1.7 tons. You definitely don't want that landing in your backyard. Your neighbor's backyard would be okay, because then you could grab it, put it in your grocery cart, and you could make a heck of a return on that, because it's probably gold impregnated. Solar activity has strongly affected ROSAT's decay, and I'll tell you why. Because only a few months ago, experts expected the satellite to re-enter in December, about 2 months from now. However, they did not anticipate the recent increase in sunspot count. Like, who did? Extreme ultraviolet radiation from sunspots has heated and puffed up Earth's atmosphere, accelerating the rate of orbital decay. The massive observatory now has a date with its home planet in October. By the way, there's something else out there that's heating up the atmosphere and puffing it up, and that's HARP. If you would like to be part of tonight's program, and I definitely encourage you to do so, we have a couple of numbers. You can reach us toll-free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471. And if you're not in North America, either on planet or off planet, you can reach us at 530-413-4511. And if you have to go out, which I would encourage you to do your Christmas shopping early, because many stores are not carrying the inventory that they did last year, And so if you want good selections, you probably need to go out this month or early next month. Do so while you're listening to the BBS conference line, and that is 760-569-7676, and then dial the passcode 192-919-pound. You'll be able to listen to the program. You won't be able to call in while you're listening, you'll be able to listen to what's going on. If you find something particularly exciting or poignant, we encourage you to call in because we could always use your presence on the program. Next week, if you are a sky watcher, by the way, if you were out last night at somewhere around 7:36, or maybe 8:36, yes, 8:36 Eastern time, you would have seen the space station go overhead. If you haven't seen it go overhead, it is quite spectacular. It went over last night at about a -3.5. That's exceedingly bright. That's as bright as Jupiter in the sky. It takes about 2 or 3 minutes for it to cross the sky at almost 19,000 miles an hour. It's up around 220, 230 miles up, but you can see it very, very clearly. With a pair of binoculars, you can even make out the solar panels on it. It's quite spectacular. And, you know, it's always a good thing. It's like predicting an eclipse. Go out with your friends and say, oh, by the way, spaceship's coming over tonight at 9:15 sharp. Yeah, right, spaceship. No, I'm serious, spaceship. And it's got beings on it. If you don't believe me, look right over there at 9:15. Step outside for whatever you do when you step outside at night. And take a look up with your friends. I promise you, it is most impressive, especially when they say, no, wait a minute, I think I see blinking lights on it. No, you don't. No, you don't. That's just reflected sunlight. They'll be most impressed. It's better than predicting an eclipse. But next week, Halley's Comet comes back. Now, you know that the head of Halley's Comet came apart a long, long time ago, but all that junk, all that gas, all that tail material comes back every year at this time. So if you step outside before dawn during the next week or so, you might try to catch a view of some cosmic litter that has been left behind in space by Halley's Comet. The Orionid meteor shower, it is well known around the world. It is a big cloud. We go through it for days and days. The Orionids can best be described as a junior version of the famous Perseid meteor showers. Those usually take place in August. However, I got to say the last, 10 Perseid meteor showers have been pretty lackluster. The last really spectacular one was in the mid-90s. Just unbelievable, especially in the southeast. You could see it so clearly. This year, the Orionid show is scheduled to reach its maximum before sunrise on the morning of October 22nd. The meteors are known as Orionids because the fireballs seem to fan out from a region to the north of Orion's second brightest star. And that's Betelgeuse, by the way. If you don't know which stars are Orions, you can see them in the early morning hours. They'll hit the horizon somewhere around midnight, but it takes about three and a half hours to rise to straight overhead. It is the three stars in a row that make up Orion's belt. You'll be able to see that pretty clearly. And even if you can't make out the whole body of Orion, you can know where Orion's belt is. Currently, Orion appears ahead of us in our journey around the sun. The constellation does not completely rise above the eastern horizon until about midnight Eastern time. And at its best, it's just like right before dawn, 4, 4:30. It's just crystal, crystal clear and very bright right overhead. Orionid meteors will begin to increase noticeably around October 17th, which is tomorrow, when they'll start appearing at about 5 per hour. After peaking on the morning of October 22nd, activity will begin to slowly descend, dropping back to around 5 per hour. The last stragglers usually appear sometime in early to mid-November. Now, at its peak, you can see as probably 60 to 100 per hour. It's quite spectacular. You don't have to wait very long to see them. You'll be making a lot of wishes. Take someone you think a lot of out with you. Halley's Comet has left a visible legacy in the form of these two annual meteor showers, one which is the Orionids. This will be a good year to look for them since the moon will have slimmed down to a crescent on the morning of the Orionids' peak, and will not pose much of a hindrance as far as light pollution up in the sky. The slender moon will not rise till about 2 a.m. local daylight time, so it should be well behind. Comets are the leftovers of the solar system's creation, many scientists believe. The odd bits and pieces of simple gases, methane, ammonia, carbon dioxide, and water vapor that went unused when the sun and its attendant planets came into their present form. Many scientists believe that solar systems do form out of accretion disks, and comets are the leftover building blocks. Meteoroids that are released into space out of this debris are the remnants of a comet's nucleus. All comets eventually disintegrate into meteor swarms, and Halley's is well into that process already. As you know, Edmund Halley, back in 1690, was a strong proponent for the Hollow Earth, and he also predicted the return of the comet, which bears his name, but posthumously, because he passed away before it had a chance to return. There are many gazillions of tiny particles that make up the tail that's left over. These tiny particles, mostly ranging in size from dust to sand grains, remain along the original comet's orbit, creating a sort of river of rubble in space. In the case of Halley's Comet, which has likely circled the sun many hundreds, if not thousands of times, its dirty trail of debris has been distributed more or less uniformly along its orbit. When these tiny bits of comet collide with Earth, friction with our atmosphere raises them to white heat and produces the effect popularly referred to as shooting stars. Sometimes these chunks are about the size of a walnut, and they'll come in and they'll split into two and change colors, and it's quite spectacular. I saw a fireball, I'm going to say it was back in June, and or maybe late May, and I was heading for Florida, and this thing came in slow and flaming, and it disappeared over the horizon of the trees down there by Pensacola, and I really thought it was going to hit. I thought I was going to see a big flash. But it evidently just never made it into the atmosphere. It just kind of skipped off the atmosphere and kept going. But it was quite spectacular. The orbit of Halley's Comet closely approaches the Earth's orbit at two places. One point is in the early part of May, producing a meteor display known as the Eta Aquarids. The other point comes in the middle or later part of October, producing the Orionids. The best time to watch, between 1 to 2 a.m. local daylight time until around dawn, when the shower's point of origin is highest above the horizon. The higher this point, called the radiant, the more meteors appear all over the sky. Orionids are one of just a handful of meteor showers that can be observed equally well from both the northern and southern hemispheres, because the cloud has had a chance to disperse over a very, very large area. And it's the orbit is so large that Earth actually passes through it twice in its traverse around the sun. This meteor shower is one of the better annual displays, producing about 15 to 20 meteors per hour at its peak. I have seen as many as 40 to 50 per hour on a good year. And, many people think that the cloud is homogeneous, that is to say equally dispersed, but I have found some years to be just lackluster and some years to be quite spectacular. It's just difficult to say. The best thing to do is get to a high, clear place away from light pollution, get you you know, your favorite snack, your favorite beverages, and make sure to lay down on your back watching them, because you'll get a terrible neck ache the next morning if you're standing up looking straight up at shooting stars. And besides, your peripheral vision, you can almost see horizon to horizon. Get a pickup truck and an air mattress and a blanket and a friend, and you'll enjoy it. Add the 5 to 10 sporadic meteors that always are plunging into our atmosphere, and you get a maximum of about 20 to 30 meteors an hour, which is about one every 2 minutes. So it can be not a dull night at all. Lots of wishes, to be sure. Many of you saw the movie Minority Report, yes, with Tom Cruise. If you think some of that computer technology was too far in the future, think again. The iPhone 5 has the holographic keyboard that was sported in the movie, although the one that Tom Cruise used with the gloves was much larger and much more elaborate. The technology is there, and the virtual keyboard is there, and it will be coming out, I am sure, with an iPad 3, which you may see late next year. But the whole idea behind the movie was the concept of pre-crime, that somehow it was possible using these three precogs that were linked to a computer system. They could see a slight amount into the future, and they could predict when a crime was going to be committed. And then the police would simply react ahead of time, be proactive, so to speak, and they would go arrest the person before the crime had taken place. And thus, criminals were incarcerated without ever having to really commit the crime. We thought that was just really in the future. But using cameras and sensors, the pre-crime system measures and tracks changes in a person's body movements, the pitch of their voice, and the rhythm of their speech. It also monitors breathing patterns, eye movements, blink rate, and alterations in body heat, which are used to access an individual's likelihood to commit a crime or to hit on the hot blonde at the bar. Either one, it's kind of a blurry line there. The future attribute screening technology, also known as FAST program, is already being tested on a group of government employees who volunteered to act as guinea pigs. Okay. The first test was carried out at an undisclosed location in the northeastern United States. I wonder where that could have been. According to the Department of Homeland Security, it was not at an airport, but was at a large venue that is suitable substitute for an operational setting, like a mall. Yeah. Ultimately, the system could be used not only at airports, but at border crossings and any large-scale public events like sports matches or political conventions. I don't think you'd be able to use it at a bar, for instance, because changes in people's breathing, body heat, and hormonal levels change on a minute-by-minute basis. However, civil liberties groups have called it a pseudo-technological approach and raised privacy concerns. In the 2002 Hollywood blockbuster Minority Report, Tom Cruise plays a police officer in a specialized pre-crime department. Psychics are used to give detectives foreknowledge of someone's criminal intentions. The FAST system is instead based on equipment, including infrared cameras and pressure pads to detect fidgeting. So if you're a doodler, a twiddler, a silly heart, you're going to get busted. Details of the system were obtained through the Freedom of Information laws by the Electronic Privacy Information Center based in Washington, D.C. A document they obtained said that sensors will non-intrusively collect video images, audio recordings, and psychophysiological measurements. Ginger McCall, a lawyer for the nonprofit group, told CBS News, quote, If it were deployed against the public, it would be very problematic. They should do a privacy impact assessment, especially if they're going to be rolling this out at the airport. Oh, like that's really going to be an issue. Come on. If you've taken a flight in the last 6 months, give us a call. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can reach us at 530-413-4511. I got to hear your responses to this one. Let me just back up and read her statement again. This just gets me. Ginger McCall. When is the last time you heard somebody named Ginger? Ginger McCall, a lawyer for the nonprofit group, told CBS News, if it were deployed against the public, it would be very problematic. They should do a privacy impact assessment, especially if they're going to be rolling this out at the airport. I'm telling you, Ginger, they don't care about your privacy at the airport. There is an implied consent. They broadcast it. Every few minutes, an automated public service announcement comes over the speakers, and it says that you can be searched at any time for any reason. Your carry-on can be searched. Your person can be searched. If you see anything, say something. Your privacy is already impacted at the airport. Trust me, the airports will be the first place that they roll it out. Department of Homeland Security spokesman Peter Bouguard told the technology website CNET that preliminary research had been carried out to see if the technology could detect signs of stress, which can be associated with intent to do harm or intent to introduce yourself to someone you don't know, or with the stress of going through a search and seizure line that you've never been through before. According to the documents obtained by Epic, the next trial may involve volunteer members of the public with experience in the food service industry. A likely story. They would be asked to work at a one-day VIP event, and some of them would be told to do something wrong, like smuggling in a recording device. I think if you're going to smuggle in a recording device and you know it's all part of the gig, you're probably not going to be nervous about it, right? In fact, you'd be nervous about your friend that's carrying the recording device, and that would be the ticket. That would tip you off, upset the machine, mess with it. I think it would be fun, don't you? Psych. The technology would then be used to identify the perpetrators. A Homeland Security spokesman said the FAST experiments were voluntary and did not store any information from those involved. He added, if it were to be deployed, there would be no personally identifiable information captured from people going through the system. Likely story. Vitamins are not what you think they are. I'm going to drink a little bit of water here. Hang on 1 second. Give me about 30 seconds here. I just need 30 seconds. No, I really appreciate that. Had to change my body chemistry by drinking a little bit of water. By the way, before I get into this vitamin story, I've got a book in my hands here. It's called Giza Legacy. It is probably one of the finest publications that's ever been sent to me for review. Rico Paganini put it together. Expeditions into the Mysterious Realms of the Pyramids and the Sphinx. We have had no shortage of such books on this program, but I have gone partially through this book, and I am so thoroughly impressed with the book that we're definitely going to have the author on. I'll be making the contacts this week. It is a key to both our origin and our future. One of the things I like about the book is that it vindicates my co-author, E.J. Clark, and myself, our allegation that the pyramids, specifically the three pyramids in Giza, are actually somewhere around 16,000 years old, that those pyramids were already there at the time Egyptus came to the Nile River Valley and formed, or at least established, Egypt. And that the pharaohs were so impressed with them that they made several efforts to copy them, the first of which was Saqqara, which, if you've ever been to Egypt, Saqqara is a stack of mud bricks compared to the great three pyramids that make up Giza. And they got better and better as they went, but I'm telling you, even with the great and vast reign of Egypt and all of the temples that they've built and all the accomplishments that they made, nothing came close to the pyramids. So he says on the back of his book, "Will humans overcome their technical material worldview and find their way back to the freedom of the spiritual world? This can only succeed if we can realign with the lost legacies of ancient times and can decipher that wisdom. Scientists and spiritual explorers alike are striving to penetrate the hidden worlds of Giza. The discoveries they have made are nothing short of breathtaking. Some may suspect it, while others already know. Here, both in and below the pyramids, lies the key to a liberating truth for all those who seek it, the Giza legacy." Now, you know, many of you are a little paranoid to go to Egypt. I wouldn't be. Egypt knows that tourism is its greatest resource, and they're going to protect it at all costs. So don't pass up the opportunity to go. There's treasure upon treasure there to experience. We highly encourage you to participate in that and support the private industry in Egypt. Find a bunch of people, even if they are having governmental problems, they can fix those. But we're going to have Rico Paganini on the program, and you're going to hear about the incredible, I should change that word, I mean credible sources and examinations, and these are personal examinations by him. They're not hand-me-downs. Some of the stuff is quoted from other authors, but most of the discoveries in the book are his own. This is a hardbound book with color photographs. It is just stunning, a stunning work. Giza Legacy, Rico Paganini, and we're going to have him on the program. Now, many of you have written me for the genetically engineered foods research that I have accumulated to do a couple of programs on that. That is available for you. All you have to do is write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and I'll be happy to send you my working notes from that program. Ton of stuff there, lots of links. You'll have to pick it up and sew it back on. It'll fall off so hard. You cannot believe what is being done to the world's food supply. But it gets worse. You know, there's a lot of disinformation out there, and it takes a little bit of cynicism, a little bit of skepticism, and a whole bunch of intelligence to figure out what's going on. Many of you are taking various vitamins, E, A, C, D, etc., to help your body's immune system to make up for some of the lack of nutrition in the foods that we eat, especially if you eat out a lot. One of the things that that we've learned, especially after Leonid I can't remember his last name now. I just know him by Leonid. He is a PhD now in forestry, and he translated the books about Russian gardening and about the subculture that goes with that. And one of the things that he notices in his books and in his translation of the Anastasia series is that a good portion, I think 60% of the fresh produce in Russia, comes from home gardening. even the people who live in the cities go outside of town to plant these gardens. But they don't just buy seeds and put them in the ground and, you know, go out and hoe and harvest. There's a way to do it. You actually take the seed and you put it in your mouth and let the seed absorb some of your DNA, and then you plant the seed. The seed then grows and uses some of the DNA in your saliva to create the nutrients that your particular body needs. Now, it's admittedly, it's a wild allegation, but it seems to work. Leonid says that, Sharashkin, Leonid says that it doesn't really have any proof in the Russian society because of the prolific drinking of vodka, especially homemade vodka. And so cirrhosis of the liver is a rampant disease in and throughout Russia. And so it's difficult to prove longevity. But the lack of things like diabetes, asthma, things like that, that are brought on by deficiencies in the organs of the human body is a testament that they are getting the kind of nutrients that they need to keep those organs in good health. We, on the other hand, have a tendency to succumb to all kinds of not really television advertising, because vitamin makers, except for just a plain old multivitamin, don't really do a lot of advertising. They don't really, you know, draw a lot of attention to themselves. You have to go to some place like General Nutrition Center or buy online or go to the vitamin section of Walmart. But on the back of each one of these things, it clearly says that there's no nutritive value, blah, blah, blah. You know, nothing that's in this bottle will help you in any way, and you're basically wasting your money. And the EPA but the Food and Drug Administration is like, you know, legendary, I hear, in their efforts to keep vitamins from competing with pharmaceuticals. And so I want you to listen to this story with an open mind, because there's a possibility that it is just disinformation, because it comes from the BBC Health News reports. This could be paid advertising by the major pharmaceuticals, or it could mean something. Now, I wouldn't be reading it, except that I picked up on the article, I put it in the queue, and sure enough, for the next 5 days, on just about every news program that I watch, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, blah, 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 even on the radio, I heard this story. And I thought, gee, this is a really amazing a marketing effort that's going on here, because the buzzwords, it's almost like the faxed talking points went out to all these people because they were using all the same words. Now, the allegation is that vitamins are actually killing older women. Yeah, vitamins are killing older women. Like, I'm at a loss here. I'm rubbing my head going, what the heck? The BBC Health News reports vitamins are killing older women. When it comes to vitamins, it appears you could have too much of a good thing, say researchers who report a link between their use and higher death rates among older women. I want to listen to your thoughts here. 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, 530-413-4511. I would like to hear from people who have possibly had their health decline after starting a vitamin regimen. And I would like to hear from people who, you know, have been kind of puny, maybe, you know, going from one illness to another and kind of getting run down and maybe not having any energy, changing jobs, and they're falling asleep at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, that kind of stuff. And they started taking vitamins and all that went away. I want to hear maybe a story like that as well. Now, experts have suspected for some time that supplements may only be beneficial if a person is deficient in a nutrient, like if you live off McDonald's or something. And excess may even do harm, as the study in Archives of Internal Medicine finds. Okay, well, that's a little bit like 4 out of 5 dentists say. Or the American Bread Council says that eat plenty of white bread, it's good for you. While the American Beef Council says lay off the bread, you'll only get fat, eat meat, that's what you are meant to do, it's what's for dinner. I'm a statistician, and I'm allowed to give you a professional opinion that not all statistics, not all experts are impartial. And when an expert comes on and says that excess supplements can be harmful, and it is a study in the Archive of Internal Medicine, I see a conflict of interest there. I would rather see someone by, you know, the American Bread Council say an excess of vitamins is not good for you, because they're impartial. You know, it's like cutting the crust off the bread or something. All of the women in their 50s and 60s were generally well-nourished, yet many had decided to take supplements. Multivitamins, folic acid, vitamin B6, magnesium, zinc, copper, and iron in particular appeared to be among the list of things that increased mortality risk. In other words, a higher risk of death. I get out of here. Multivitamins, folic acid, B6, magnesium, zinc, copper, iron. Have we not had this grilled into our brain for 50 years? That taking these vitamins, supplements, the rather weak and you know, nutrient-free bunch of carbohydrates and fat that we consume as our daily diet. The researchers believe consumers are buying supplements with no evidence that they will provide any benefit. Dun, dun, dun. No evidence that they will provide any benefit. That really doesn't equate with a $20 billion annual business of vitamins and supplements. Harms versus gains. Based on existing evidence, we see little justification for the general and widespread use of dietary supplements. How about that? They are quick to stress that their study relied on the 38,000 U.S. women who took part in it, recalling what vitamins and minerals they had taken over the previous 2 decades. Now, Earth Explorers, do you honestly believe that for 20 years there have been 38,000 U.S. women who took part in a study? You think so, over a 20-year period? I don't know. And it's difficult to control for all other factors like general physical health that might have influenced the findings. Smoking, drinking, not eating properly, not sleeping properly, drug abuse. I mean, there's a gazillion reasons why mortality rates would increase that have nothing to do with vitamins. Maybe they just like taking pills, and they got used to it on vitamins, and it led to heavier things. Yeah, I'm looking for that study to come out. But they say their findings suggest that supplements should only be used if, I know you're going to love this. I know you're going to love this, but you better just pull the car over to the side of the road right now, because you're going to have rage. I just know it. Go ahead and loosen your seatbelt a little bit. Because just take a couple of breaths. I'm going to. Ready? Okay, here we go. Here we go. But they say that their findings suggest that supplements should only be used if there is a strong medically based cause for doing so because of the potential to cause harm. That's right. Vitamins are harmful. And you should only take them if your doctor says it's okay. Based on existing evidence, we see little justification for the general and widespread use of dietary supplements. I think I said that way too fast, because it's got to be said. You've got to hear this. Based on existing evidence, we see little justification for the general and widespread use of dietary supplements, says Dr. Jaakko Mursu of the University of Eastern Finland and his research colleagues. I'm not raising my hand in support of this. I'm not getting it. I'm not getting it. A $20 billion annual business. I can tell you myself, as you know, a person that works out on a regular basis, that without the vitamins, you know, I'm pretty puny. But when I take the vitamins on a regular basis, I have a lot more stamina. I never get sick. I haven't had a cold in I don't know when. You know, I have good eyesight. I have good skin. All my toenails are in good shape. I mean, come on. Vitamins, and if you have a little excess to them, you're just going to shed them off. That's what bodies do. We're designed to do that. But if we don't get enough, we start robbing from other places in the body, like the bones. And, I'm not a proponent for massive doses, but a multivitamin and some supplements for the increased activity that you're doing, whether you're scuba diving or whether you're sitting sedentary at a desk all day, there are vitamin supplements that you can take to help. And I just, you know, if you've got any feelings on this, any thoughts on this, I would really like to hear them. Let's hear from Diane in Michigan. Welcome to the program.
Well, hi, Brooks. How are you?
I am doing great. Tell me that you take vitamins on a regular basis.
You hit my hot button. I am hot with this. I am furious with this. I mean, first of all, you have to deal with the fact that everybody who is programmed to watch the idiot box that watches the programming of every pharmaceutical company that puts their crap for advertisement and gives you everything that you can die from, all right, and all the repercussions from taking these particular, this prescription, okay, and then you take a look and you can do a research, and there is no one, and I have done many researches on this because I am very part of the Codex Amateurus revolt, that has ever been sick or died. They might have a reaction, all right, from a vitamin or a mineral, but most of us are totally depleted of both, and that's why disease sets in to begin with, because God gave us everything on this earth, including there is no one that should ever starve, because you can go out and eat the grass just like the cows do and the horses do and the deer do. There are more foods out, and I teach classes in eating in the wild and taking water from the trees in order to get liquid. This is absolutely absurd, and because what they're trying to do is reinforce the Codex Alimentarius so that when they start eliminating, which they already have done and they already have been doing, eliminating all of the minerals and vitamins through this codex, all right, and this is global, all right, it's already started in Europe and so forth and so on, and we're getting ready. In fact, I believe, I could be wrong in this, but I do believe that it's going to be January 1st, 2012, that much of this is going to be instituted.
I'm with you.
It's all propaganda.
I watch TV, and, you know, it'll say something like, take Boliva, one pill a day and or one pill a month, and, you know, it prevents bone loss. And the side effects are, you know, dry mouth, intestinal upset, and death, you know. In the study, it said iron tablets were strongly linked with a small 2.4% increased death risk. 2.4%? Come on, you know. Five times that amount die from taking, Lipitor. So,
exactly. This Dr. Jacob Misu, you said?
Yeah.
He is bought and paid for probably by Eli Lilly. I mean, this is so absurd. You know, I have a sister, unfortunately, who has cancer. And because she would not take the natural vitamins and so forth, she had a mastectomy, and it traveled. Most mastectomies do travel within a year to 2 years right to the liver, and now she has liver and pancreatic. And the only reason what they want to do is just fill her with radiation and chemotherapy. I mean, there's only a 3% success rate within a 5-year. If you go over, if you, they do not count anything over 5 years. So if you die in 5 years in one day, you're not part of the program.
Most of them died. It was only a 3% success rate.
When you go to other countries, no other country in the world except the Western countries use chemotherapy and radiation. That has to tell you something. And no one has a higher rate of cancer than this country.
I didn't know that.
And the Western world, I should say, the Western world. Or the worlds that have been westernized with McDonald's and fast foods.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. We're eating foods that have been grown outside of our neighborhood. We're eating cabbage that was grown in Southern California. We're eating beef that was raised in, you know, Iowa, or corn, soybeans that were raised in Nebraska. Or, you know, we're eating foods that come from soil, that are pollinated by bees, that, you know, drink the minerals, that are not from where we live. So the antigens that we're exposed to in Chicago or in New York or in Louisville are not the antigens that our foods are preparing us for.
That's exactly right. But even on top of that, I mean, we've been poisoned by our water with fluoride. We've been poisoned by our soil through years and years of using pesticides and herbicides and now GMO through Monsanto. I mean, we have been poisoned through our air, through chemtrails. I mean, we can't even grow organic. I'm an organic farmer, and I have to tell you, I have, you know, several greenhouses. I have to keep everything in the greenhouse because the chemtrails are so, and I'm not certified organic, but I can tell you through my heart I'm organic, all right, because I won't go through the hoops and the jumps and everything else that they put you through to be organic.
We have been
ambushed, and we have been lied and deceived in every avenue. And all these people, including my sister, who believes that the doctors are the ones that are telling them the truth, and they destroyed her. She's 52 years old with liver and pancreatic cancer, and I know that I can help her, but without her listening, she's going in for additional radiation treatment because she believes in the doctors.
Yeah, I'm sure that's something that exists in nature, is bombarding your body with high energy protons to
Well, I think if you go in for radiation, you should just throw yourself into a microwave oven, turn it on.
Well, they do have a tendency to be able to target the exact tissue, and you know, the theory is that cancerous tissue is more dense than healthy tissue, and so the incidence of collision is much higher. But once it metastasizes,
but they kill the white blood cells and the killer T cells, that your body heals itself, given the right nutrients and the right vitamins, and that's why they're going to attack. And you're going to see in the very near future, I mean tomorrow, the next day, and so on, a huge attack. Because they're getting ready to install, and they have to propagate this in order to brainwash the people that the vitamins and the minerals are not good for you.
And this is why we're seeing the stories.
And radiation are.
This is why we're seeing the stories that, you know, that the drugs that we're trying to get you to ask your doctor for with the commercials in between, you know, our favorite programs.
All side effects.
That's the way we should go. But you can't advertise for vitamin E or vitamin A or vitamin D. You can advertise for a multivitamin with zinc, you know, sponsored by the AARP or something like that. But you can't advertise, you know, the benefits of bean sprouts or organically grown this or unpasteurized milk. I read the story, I don't know, last year, maybe it was early this year, of the guy who was selling unpasteurized milk and they performed a sting operation. And he transported the unpasteurized milk across state lines.
Oh, yeah.
And they
imprisoned
him for a felony.
I only use raw milk.
I just, and now we have the new food regulations coming out. What is it? The Food Safety Act that's out. And the police and Homeland Security get involved, and they're really clamping down on these organic farmers that are, you know, they're growing seeds.
Just like this last with the listeria with the cantaloupe and the tomatoes and the spinach. Let's go back to history just a few years. This is all incremental. This is all compartmentalized. So let's just do this so that the people believe this when none of this has ever happened. It's just like getting skin cancer, melanoma, okay, because you're being out in the sun, all right? And the Christian and the religions that claim that those that worship the sun. Well, the sun, without the sun, there is no life. It's the S-U-N of God, not the S-O-N of God.
Was there any truth to the listeria scare? Were people really dying from eating melons?
I don't believe that for a minute. And if it did take place, I'm not saying it didn't. I don't believe it. But if it did, just like the tomatoes and the spinach, and you go on and on and on over the past 5 or 6 years that this has gone, every year there's something, you know, Ebola or, you know, listeria, whatever. Monsanto can go in and taint any crop that they want. Look how many cases have gone to court to take the small farmer or the medium-sized farmer out of business, organic or not.
That's true.
I work with these farmers up here. I've been very involved, and they had no idea. I when I see a truck with Monsanto goods, with Roundup Ready in the back of their truck, Roundup corn, I pull them over. I literally pull them. I kind of veer them off. When they get out, they get angry. And most of them are still angry when I leave them, but at least I give them information to think about.
Well, we had an interview with a farmer up in Canada that had gone to court with Monsanto, and they had won. What had happened was Monsanto had somehow thrown seeds, genetically engineered seeds, into a field of corn. And then, Monsanto went and took a sample of the corn, found their genetic marker, sued the farmer to pay Monsanto for their marker, you know, because they had patented the gene. Well, the farmer won, but the court did uphold Monsanto's patent on the gene. That's the scary thing.
That's right. We have lost thousands upon thousands of American farmers and Canadian farmers as a result of Monsanto and Cargill, as a result of the propaganda that has been put out as they plant it, because the whole thing is Agenda 21, and that they are going to take over all the big agriculture companies, and both in animal and in agriculture, are taking over the United States and Canada and the Western world. And I'll tell you what's happening in New York and what's happening in L.A. and what's happening around the world with the Wall Street, these kids are getting smart. You know why? Because they're on the Internet. And in the end times, knowledge will increase, and I believe that the increase of knowledge by far is the Internet. And now we are able to connect around the world with people to find out the truth for those that have eyes to see and ears to hear. And that, I'll leave it with that. Thank you very much, Brooks, for your incredible, and, you know, we've met before. You know who I am.
Oh, yeah.
And I can't wait to see you again someday. I'm hoping to be to the Pythagoras Conference.
Hey, that's within driving distance. You can drive down to Louisville.
Oh, no, I know I can. I know I can. But I would like to get a couple people to go with me. I don't want to do it by myself.
Yeah.
But if I have to, I will.
During the break. All right, Diane, I really appreciate the call. I didn't mean
thanks,
to hit
Brooks.
You.
Thanks, Brooks. Thanks for your programming.
It's powerful stuff. Alex, one of my
people, wake up.
There you go. Diane says, wake up. Wake up and eat properly.
Bye-bye.
Alex says, we are digging our graves with our teeth because we eat from the center aisles of the market and the pharmacy to take the pain away from being poisoned to death. Oh, my gosh. Analgesics, painkillers, number one sellers. They outsell all vitamins combined. Come on, people. Take vitamins, not pain pills. Jeez Louise, come on. Anyway, I just want to go ahead and finish this. Diane is so powerful. She's such an activist when it comes to this stuff, and we really, really appreciate her intelligence and her spirit. You know, the argument that's made, too much can be toxic, and it's easy to inadvertently take more than the recommended daily amount. Holy cow. You can take more than the recommended daily amount of Tylenol and kill yourself. Too much of a good thing. What an argument. Conversely, calcium supplements appear to reduce death risk. However, the researchers say this finding needs more investigation, and they do not recommend that people take calcium unless advised to by a doctor in order to treat a deficiency. Come on, people. Osteoporosis is the loss of calcium. You lose it by not using your muscles, by not stressing your bones. So the body just does what's natural, and it sloughs it off. Doctors Christian Glude and Goran Bielakovic, who review research from for the Cochrane database of systemic reviews to evaluate best evidence, said, quote, "We think the paradigm the more the better is wrong." They say dietary supplementation has shifted from preventing deficiency to trying to promote wellness and prevent diseases. And caution, we believe that for all micronutrients, risks are associated with insufficient and too large intake. Helen Bond of the British Dietetic Association said some people, like the elderly, might need to take certain supplements. For example, vitamin D is recommended for people over the age of 65. But she said that generally people should be able to get all the vitamins and minerals they need from a healthy, balanced diet. She said some took supplements as an insurance policy, wrongly assuming that they could do no harm. But too much can be toxic, and it is easy to inadvertently take more than the recommended daily amount. Okay, wait a minute. If you look on the back of any vitamin bottle, not, of course, things like, Centrum and One a Day and stuff like that, that's kind of implied. But if you look at the back of them, it doesn't tell you a dosage. It doesn't tell you a dose. It just says recommended, you know, one with a meal or whatever. Believe me, you're not going to overdose if you take vitamins like this. In fact, a lot of vitamins have, especially tablets, they don't dissolve well in the bowel. You take them, and you might take them with food, and the food gets digested, but the vitamin gets passed right through and out in your excrement it goes. The gel caps are the ones that dissolve the easiest. And I'm not recommending, massive doses of anything. But I could tell you, I've been taking vitamins for over 30 years. And I haven't had a cold, not a cavity, nothing. Not an infection of any kind. And it's not because I have superior genetics. It's because I take care of myself and I take vitamins. The vitamins help the immune system. I don't care what any doctor says. It does help the immune system. So any other comments about that, I would welcome them. In the meantime, let's take a quick break. We'll listen to a little bit of After the Gold Rush by our favorite band, the Alice Band, a little a cappella. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio.
Saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're so glad you're part of our program here tonight. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains in North Carolina. Our IQ window forecast is 68 degrees and clear tonight. It's been a wonderful, wonderful week and got a lot of work done, a lot of good stuff. If you want to be part of the program tonight, don't forget to call in 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can get to us at 530-413-4511. Good Skype messages coming in. Great phone call by Diane up in Michigan about our piece on vitamins. Too much of a good thing. Doesn't seem fair that pharmaceuticals can run commercials on TV. I guess if I were elected president, that'd be the first thing that I would ban. You can't ask your doctor about anything. We're not in the business of advertising drugs on TV. And if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander, then we'll allow food supplement companies to talk about that as well. Any kind of supplement that you want to advertise on TV would be all right, if it's buyer beware. And there wouldn't be any side effects, too. You wouldn't have to worry about runny nose and anal leakage and death like you do with all the pharmaceuticals that you see. And there are a lot of juicers out there. Alex says juice blackberries, raspberries, blueberries with some whey protein, and you have brain-powered and jumpstart your day. Wow, good for you. Sounds good. Brazil nuts and avocados have appropriate fat for your brain. I need fat for my brain, and it's got to be something other than a quarter pounder with cheese, too. It just... even though it's got 560 calories, it does fit the calorie diet. It's the wrong stuff, people. Come on. Use your head. Eat health food. Eat Taco Bell. Come on. Taco Bell's good. The meat that's in it doesn't have enough beef in it to actually be considered meat. So you're not really eating meat. It's, you know, it's health food, nothing fried. All right, let's get on to our next story. You're listening to X Squared Radio. This is the second hour. I do want to tell you about a couple things. The book, Giza Legacy, by Rico Paganini, hardbound, absolutely stunning publication. Color photographs, just so well done. It's got a lot of 3D graphics that are in it, 60 maps, 350 color photos. You know, this is a really nice book to have on the shelf. We're going to get Rico on the program. We're going to talk about this book. He's one of the better researchers out there that we've spoken to in recent years. I also want to remind you that if you live anywhere in the United States, your central point is Louisville, Kentucky. And that is precisely the point that Sandra Sabatini and her excellent staff have founded the Pythagoras Conference. Now, it's December 18th, I believe. I want you to click on the Pythagoras Conference link at xsquaredradio.com. It's the blue one on the right-hand side. The conference registration has been greatly discounted, and it's buy one, get one free. And it's at the Galt House. I mean, come on. That's like the White House. The Galt House is one of the nicest hotels in the Midwest. Right there on the river, it's a gorgeous hotel. It's a very easy venue to get to. 20 of the top speakers in this genre of paranormal science, 20 of them in the Midwest. Now, when have you ever seen that happen? It's never happened before. I mean, you see some, you know, ghost hunter things like that and, you know, around, but not of a class like this. This is the kind of conference you find on the West Coast only. Sandra Sabatini is bold in bringing this to the Midwest. You don't have to fly. You can drive. If you live in Chicago, if you live in Atlanta, Louisville is within driving distance. So I want you to get to that badge on X Squared Radio, click on it, and get signed up for this. This is the kind of conference that isn't just a fun weekend. It's a life changer, the Pythagoras Conference. Well, we've done a couple stories, and I've even been on the Kevin Smith Show, and we've talked about this as well. My good friend Kevin Smith is on Monday through Friday at 8 p.m. Mountain Time, kevinsmithshow.com. It's arguably, probably one of the biggest internet talk radio programs in the world. I think we're fast coming up on him in North America, at least on Sunday nights. He's not on, but you've got Monday through Friday with Kevin Smith and then Sunday with Brooks Agnew. So here we are. this conference, by the way, coming up, Alex is writing in a conference on what? This is the kind of conference that can really change your life. It is so eye-opening. You're going to have expert archaeology there. You're going to have leading-edge physics with Dr. Ed Close. You're going to have research on time travel. You're going to have all kinds of ancient America archaeology speakers. We've got the author of Forbidden Archaeology, Michael Cremo. You just don't get a better class of speaker than this at this event. Friday through Sunday, you just cannot pass this one up, the Pythagoras Conference in Louisville, Kentucky. Alex, welcome to the program.
Hey, Brooks. What's up?
Well, we just got done with a blistering segment on how vitamins are bad for you, according to doctors. You shouldn't
be taking. Actually, I was calling in on that. Wanted to quote a few statistics that Diane, or a few facts that Diane forgot to mention.
Well, Diane's a little excitable.
Did you know
she's
that sometime in the 70s, Jacques Cousteau actually addressed I think it was the WHO in a conference, stating that about 300,000 people a year have to be basically put down in order to conserve our planet. The way they're doing that is through pharmaceuticals.
Well, you know that this week we're supposed to hit a global population of 7 billion for the first time.
Yeah, sweet. The more efficient we can, the more there are, the more efficiently I guess you could say the majority rules, I guess you could say, so they're getting scared.
Many hands make light work.
Anyway, yeah, they want a monopoly on the food industry so that they can say what we eat, so they can manipulate population growth through the food.
Well, I believe that.
They can't do it.
I don't know who is, you know, manipulating the population growth. I do know that the pharmaceutical industries, on the one hand, they have a heck of a challenge. You know, they got to go through all this research and blah, 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 and then they introduce a drug, and then, but then they charge for it and make their money back. And some of the drugs do have a benefit, but the vast majority of the drugs that they produce are treatments for symptoms. They're not cures.
Yeah, and they're also, let's see, a lot of them are extracts from plants that people have been using for ages. Of course, when you extract the active ingredient that makes the result, you sort of separate the components that make it so it doesn't have side effects.
Ah, that's a good point.
For instance,
that's a good point. Eat the whole plant, it's beneficial.
And whatever.
Yeah, you eat the whole plant or eat the root or whatever, and it's beneficial. But if you extract only the active compound and put it into a pill, you don't have the balance that nature intended for that plant to have.
Exactly. Nature is the best pharmacologist, I guess you could say. It has
I hear his lifeline going in the background. We'll wait.
Yeah. Anyway, the reason that, let's see. Here's an interesting piece of trivia that sort of drives home your point that you can't really overdose on vitamins. I have so much iron in my blood, I bleed black.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I think that has to do with a time when I was really young, when I OD'd on a multivitamin that was high in iron. But anyway, it's not neither here nor there. Anyway, I jokingly, every time I go into a blood drive, I jokingly said, good luck inserting the needle. I've got so much iron in my blood system, I'm bulletproof. Just kidding.
Interesting stuff. Alex, I appreciate the call, and thanks. Keep the texts coming.
See you later. Helps. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. You know, we talked about the science of economics on our program before we get into this story about the Antarctic, because I think you're really going to enjoy this. We've talked about this sub-ice lake in the Antarctic a couple of times, both on this program and on the Kevin Smith Show, and I think you're going to find it interesting what they have found there and what they're going after. But in the science of economics, I wanted to do a little bit of research because I've been kind of piqued to this by Ron Paul, Congressman Ron Paul, who is a candidate for the presidency. He was actually talking to the Fed chairman, Bernanke. And he was nailing his shirt tails to the table, because one of the things that he spoke to him about was inflation and what causes inflation, and was the money that the Fed was creating out of thin air based on gold. And, of course, Bernanke had to just drop his face and say, no, it's not. Money is not gold. And so I did a little bit of research, and I found this article that was written this year by Chris Weber on Where is America's Gold? The Mystery of Fort Knox. Now, he's written a book on it. I'm going to get the book, and then I'm going to interview him on the program. But I want to just run this article by you because this is really the heart of the matter. When you ask the question, you know, where's all the money gone? Where did it go? We got all these corporations and banks and insurance companies and everything, and no one knows where the money's gotten to. So, and before we get into this really deeply, let's go ahead and get Zana from Dallas on the program. Welcome to the program, Zana.
Now, he's written a book on it.
Hello.
You're going to have to turn your computer off because you're going to get an echo from me.
Okay, I did.
Very good, very good. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
All right. Well, what have you been listening to tonight that's got you convinced to call in? I'll be as nice as I can.
Well, I've listened to you several times, and I was listening to you talk about vitamins, and I just had to throw in my 2 cents worth.
Well, I want you to.
From what I've been studying, most people in the United States are at least deficient in vitamin D3. And osteoporosis is completely connected to D3 deficiency. And you can take as much calcium as you want. Without D3, it doesn't really work.
Yeah, it just goes right through you. You don't even, I mean, you'll digest it, but it won't build your bone mass.
Right. And I was at a fairly young age suffering from some bone loss, but I had another problem, which was celiac disease that I didn't know about. But I was taking D3, and I actually had to get up to 10,000 units a day to make it work. But I know for sure that I'm building my bone mass again, and there are other things involved. And I'm also convinced that taking calcium, and perhaps maybe even the wrong calcium, actually calcifies your whole body rather than building your bones.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like it can actually exacerbate things like a bone deposit in the joints, like arthritis.
Absolutely.
Well,
and
I've heard,
the other thing is, as far as the vitamins go, that the pharmaceutical companies, of course, have been trying to control that industry for a very long time, and we've been fighting it in the States for a very long time because if they controlled that industry, of course, they would control everything nutritionally, and that would not be good. I don't know that we're all extremely informed and intelligent enough to make all the best decisions about what we take, but I think that it would be wrong to let someone else take control of that industry.
Well, I find it, how do you feel about being bombarded when you're watching television and you have an ad come on that says, you know, ask your doctor about this drug or that drug, and then they talk about the side effects, you know, blindness and sterility and blah, 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 and death. God, can't leave out death. We're getting all these drugs to treat symptoms. There's no cure.
Absolutely. Cures. And I'm a yoga teacher and a health and wellness coach, and I absolutely believe in, you know, whole nutrition and organic foods and all the, you know, the best ways to get it. I watch those commercials you're talking about, and I'm scratching my head because half the time they don't even tell you really what's wrong. They just tell you to ask your doctor about that medication.
Like your doctor is not already getting hit by the drug rep to prescribe it to the patients. Now,
I have three friends who are doctors, and they get taken out two or three times a week to the best restaurants in Dallas and courted and, you know, and sold all these drugs, and it's a travesty.
One of my close friends was a salesperson for Pfizer for 20 years, and he made his living on just doing that. Wining and dining doctors, talking about drug-drug interactions and, you know, how their drug is better than Libby's drug or, you know, some other company's drug. But my question is, if the pharmaceutical companies can get on and talk about, you know, Believer, Lipitor, or, you know, I did this or I did that, I asked my doctor about this and I feel better, why can't people get on and say, you know, I'm taking you know, Citracal. I'm taking vitamin B3 and I'm feeling a lot better. I was, you know, bedridden and now I'm playing tennis again. You know, why can't vitamin companies advertise as well?
Well, I think they can. I just think they don't want to spend the money to do it. And, you know, I see a lot of those infomercials on vitamins on, you know, late at night or whatever, that do advertise the things that, you know, help you nutritionally and the vitamin, you know, products and everything. And I think that's great. But unfortunately, unless you've studied this in depth, it would be really hard for the average person to know what they really needed and if they actually had a deficiency. And I heard you talk earlier about multivitamins, and I think, you know, I kind of agree with Dr. Oz, and that's your best bet if you don't know what's really going on. But after fighting a serious immune disease myself and struggling through that, which there was no medical cure for, and being back on top of things now and feeling absolutely wonderful and amazing, and I give myself B12 injections and take, you know, some of the supplements I really know to take, I would say that, you know, if that was all taken away from us and it had to be in prescription form, that we would be suffering.
Sure. Well, let me ask you a question. You're a health and wellness coach. You teach yoga. You know, I'm about as flexible as the chair that I sit in all day doing my engineering work. I used to play sports all the time and tennis and golf, and I was pretty flexible for a big guy, but now I'm less flexible. How does yoga and flexibility and wellness of mind and balanced nutrition, what does it do for the quality of life?
Well, what you're doing actually, and since you're a Merkaba practitioner, which I am trying to learn myself, what you're doing is you're connecting your body and your mind, and when they work together, you've got it made. It's kind of like the whole, you know, Bruce Lipton theory, and that is we're more energy beings than we are chemical or anything else. And so if you can get that energy connected, which is what I believe and what I teach, then you've got it made.
You know what I notice about most of the people that I work with in cubicle land is nobody that I know really takes a deep breath. You know, they
breathing
all this,
is,
oh my god,
breathing
gosh,
yeah. is essential.
Yeah,
and focused breathing is essential.
You know, people will say, "What are you doing over there? Are you breathing? Having a hard time breathing?" No, I'm not having a hard time. I'm taking a deep breath. Don't you ever breathe deeply? You know, expand your lungs, get air to the nethermost part of that balloon in your chest called your lungs.
Well, I think we forget to breathe. I mean, we forget to really focus on our breath.
Well, you know, interesting, and we're autonomic beings. You know, we breathe and we sleep, and we don't have to think about it. But conscious breathing.
It's awesome.
At least for Merkaba, oh my gosh. You know, a lot of people don't know this, but whales and dolphins don't breathe autonomically. They breathe consciously.
And I have heard that, and I understand that. And I think, you know, some of the old yogis, you know, breathe so deeply and so strongly that they're able to even quit breathing and slow their body down so much that they could, you know, just exist for a very long time without that.
I notice when I'm doing the 18th breath, which is the final breath after you do the 17 breaths of the Merkaba, it's a maintenance breath. It kind of keeps you in a meditative state for prolonged periods of time, that you forget to breathe. You literally go into a hyper-oxygenated state, and you stop. You can stop breathing for 2 or 3 minutes and not realize it.
There you go. And I want to get there. I have not practiced your Merkaba yet, but I've read and studied a little bit about it. I'd like to study with Maureen. And actually, I looked up her website recently and wanted to find her in a conference. So if you know about that soon, please let us
know. Yeah. She teaches classes regularly all around the country. She's a wonderful teacher. My master, I've taken 2 advanced classes from her, and I you know, I vote for her. She's the best Merkaba teacher in the country, I think.
I get that, and I'd love to study with her. And I was so inspired by listening to you talk about that. And it, you know, aside from what we're talking about with the vitamins and the nutrition and everything, the Merkaba is probably essential to life, honestly.
Yeah. Well, just outstanding. I appreciate your call so much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you.
Well, I feel appreciated now. Thanks very much.
I'll be listening.
All right. Thank you very much, Zana.
Thank you.
All right. That's a new caller, by the way, Zana from Texas, I believe. Nice to hear her voice. The interesting story by Chris Weber, The Mystery of Fort Knox. In a few months, we'll celebrate the 40th anniversary. Actually, this happened a couple of months ago because this was August 15th, 1971, that the U.S. defaulted on its promise to pay gold for dollars. It is now clear that they didn't have very much gold left to pay. Chris says, I've used the government's own words and statements to paint a picture I think is shocking. There has never been an accounting of this gold, and there never has been a real audit of it. I know people say there was one in 1953, but he says in his book, I wonder if anyone really can believe this. At every turn, when the government was asked to provide proof, even by Ron Paul, of either the amount of gold they have left or the quantity of it, they have answered with lies and evasions. They have been acting like they have something to hide. What we do know is that until August 15th, 1971, any foreign central bank could go to the U.S. Treasury and buy official U.S. gold at $35 per ounce. It was the last link to the international gold standard. Before then, all currencies were defined in terms of the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. dollar was defined in terms of gold. A dollar equaled 1/35 of an ounce of gold. $35 equaled 1 troy ounce of gold. You've heard me say on this program that the secret to life is clean glassware and conversion factors. There's one for you. But on that day, the gold window closed. Since then, no more U.S. government gold has been exchanged for U.S. paper money. He uncovers a 1975 letter from the Washington, D.C. director of the General Accounting Office, the GAO. Quoting U.S. Treasury sources, the GAO director pretty much comes out and says that there was almost no more good delivery gold left. This means that the gold that would be acceptable on international markets and have a purity of 0.995 or better, that's 99.5% or better purity, was almost gone by the time Nixon closed the gold window. They knew that there was almost nothing left that was of a purity acceptable to foreign central banks. We can only guess at what remains and the purity of it. In fact, we could do more than guess if the government only let the sunlight in. The technology now exists to scan each bar of gold and see how much gold it really contains. There could be independent accountants that have a generally public procedure to show how much the U.S. government has. Now, he's got a table in here. This is of January 31st of this year, 2011. Gold bullion. This is the status report of U.S. Treasury. There are 258 million 641,851.485 troy ounces of gold. I'm going to go down here to where it's talking about the countries that have gold. Ah, here we go. The U.S., 261.5 million troy ounces. Germany, 109.37 million troy ounces. The IMF, that's the International Monetary Fund, 92.1 million troy ounces. Italy, 78.5 6.83 million troy ounces, which I have a hard time believing because Italy is on the verge of bankruptcy right behind Greece. France, almost exactly the same as Italy, 78.3 million troy ounces. China, and this one's going to blow your mind, China, only 33.9 million troy ounces, although China's holdings are growing rapidly, and this may be out of date. This was of January of this year now. China is arguably the number one economy in the world with all of its cash, but not much gold to back it. Behind China, Switzerland, and Russia. So officially, the U.S. has more than twice its nearest rival, Germany. It has nearly eight times as much as China. Again, officially. But China has quietly become the world's largest producer of gold. And the Chinese central bank buys 100% of all production at the market price. I'm sure they make certain this gold is of the utmost purity. I'm suspicious, he says, of the official Chinese total, which I really believe is a state secret and may be much higher than they state in this report. In any event, it is the U.S. gold that this article is all about. We need to finally see what is left of the gold that was confiscated from the American people in 1933. We need to know how much is left from the 702 million ounces the U.S. had in 1949, when this was by far the most gold ever held by one owner in history. That's 4 years after World War II. We had 702 million ounces, and now, according to this report, only 261. Almost one-third the gold we had in 1949. Where did it all go? Where did that gold go? I don't see almost 500 troy ounces between all the other countries combined. So who has the gold? Where did the money go? Are you guys doing the math along with me? 702 million troy ounces. We now have 261 million. All the other countries combined make up less than the difference. And if China is the number one producer of gold in the world right now, and they're buying it at market price, where did all the gold go? Where is the value in our society? That's the question I want to get answered. Our number, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, 530-413-4511. Excellent, excellent calls tonight. Keep them coming. We've got about a little less than half an hour left in this hour. Let's get into this Antarctic Lake mission. The reason this is important, we've talked about this underground, under ice lake in the Antarctic. We've talked about the power supply that they found and how ostensibly the NSA went in and seized the entire mission, and there are only 9 or 10 people down there working. Officially, that's true in the Antarctic winter, because the winters are like 95 below zero, and you can't drill in that kind of weather. None of the equipment works. You can only drill during the 3 months of summer. And so, yes, they do reduce the manpower down there. But weather at this site is notoriously stormy. It requires special protection, not only for the people, but also for the gear. A pioneering British expedition to sample a lake under the Antarctic ice hopes to find unknown forms of life and clues to future climate impacts. As you know, the Antarctic continent of ice has been growing for the last 5 decades and is now at a record size, while the Arctic ice flow has not really recovered from the 2007 losses. As you know, the Earth's temperature rose until 1998, where it stabilized, and the planet has not appreciably begun to cool. However, all the major glaciers in the world are increasing in size right now. The mission in Antarctica will use hot water to melt its way through the ice. Of course, it takes a lot of energy to make that hot water in a remote site. It's been isolated from the outside world for at least 125,000 years, and some are guessing a million years it's been isolated from the outside world. So there could be, there most assuredly will be, life or the remnants of life in this lake. For one thing, it's liquid. For another thing, there's airspace down there. So wherever there's energy and there's water, there will be life. Our planet is famous for it. The team hopes to be the first to sample a subglacial Antarctic lake. An engineering team leaves the UK later this week along with 70 tons of gear. Of course, you know they're getting ready for the Antarctic summer down there. We're heading into winter up here in the northern hemisphere. The project, funded to the tune of £7 million by the UK's Natural Environment Research Council, aims to obtain samples of the lake water itself and of sediment on the lake floor. There is some caution with this. The Australians have a council where they're issuing some warnings about penetrating into this biosphere. Be careful, they say, not to let out any microbes that haven't seen the surface in possibly a million years. We might not have any immunity against it. So that's one of the cautions. The other is who is going to own the information. Professor Martin Siegert from the Edinburgh University, our project will look for life in Lake Ellsworth and look for the climate record of West Antarctic ice sheet, said the project. He's the principal investigator down there. Wouldn't you know it'd be a Scot down there doing it? Absolutely. We are the ones out there in the very coldest frontiers looking for things like the magnetic North Pole. If we're successful, we'll make profound discoveries on both the limits to life on Earth and the history of West Antarctica, he told BBC News. Understanding the West Antarctic ice sheet is crucial to forecasting future climate change impacts. What they do is they take a core of this and they're able to look at the ice that's been deposited over the last 7,000 years, and they can tell whether it was heavy snowfall, what was in the atmosphere at the time, because the clouds that deposit the snow on the surface that then become the glacier that we know as Antarctica is a good partial pressure sample, a chemical sample of what was in the air at that time. So they know what the temperature was, they know how many volcanoes had erupted, whether there were any things like asteroid impacts or cometary impacts or anything like that by sampling this ice. So it's a good snapshot of what happened in the past. It holds enough ice to raise sea levels globally by at least 10 feet because, as you know, Antarctica has ice on top of dry land. So if the ice is just floating in the water, it's obviously not going to raise sea level if it melts back into the sea. But if it melts off dry land where it's being held up by the continent, then it will raise, could be as high as 23 feet. And if it's as high as 23 feet, you could say goodbye to Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. You're going to have water way on up into the new seashore of southern Kentucky. Exploring subglacial lakes may also help scientists design missions to search for life on other worlds, such as Jupiter's moon Europa, which is thought to feature a liquid ocean beneath a thick layer of ice. We learn how to do it here and perfect the way of doing it, then we can robotically take that drilling equipment to a moon and drill for samples there as well. Lake Ellsworth is about 10 kilometers long, 2.3 kilometers wide, and about the same size as Lake Windermere, England's biggest lake. Any form of life we find there, we won't have encountered before, says Dr. David Pierce. But that is where the similarity ends. Ellsworth lies in a valley in the bedrock of Antarctica, with 3 kilometers of ice above it. The water is kept liquid by natural geothermal heat coming from the Earth's interior. It has been mapped by using ground-penetrating radar and seismic tests. This is where they actually blow charges off and map the vibrations as they go down through the solid part of the ice and ground and come back up. And they listen with geophones and make a map of it. They know they're looking for a lake. They know it has a headspace above it. Among other things, those investigations revealed that the lake has a soft floor, which presumably means a thick layer of sediment, which means it's spring-fed or it's river-fed, and that that river is flowing into that lake. But reaching the lake and taking samples involves a mission that pushes the boundaries of engineering skill and ingenuity. The hot water drill is basically a spraying device on the bottom of a hose, and the hose is 3.2 kilometers long. That's a long hose. 90,000 liters of pure water will be made at the Ellsworth site by heating and then filtering ice using a boiler taken along for the purpose. I don't know what the boiler runs on. I would assume natural gas. It will be pumped down the 3.2 kilometer long hose and out of the nozzles at the bottom. Hopefully the hose doesn't have a blowout or worse, the water refreeze above the structure down there and actually freeze the hose into the hole. So you can tell there are a lot of challenges with this. With the water at a scalding 97 degrees C, that's almost boiling, it should melt a smooth uniform hole about 36 centimeters across. It's about 12 inches down to the bottom of the ice. I hope that they have some kind of seal or a cap or some packing device there, because the last thing in the world you want is for this headspace to burp into our atmosphere some new microbe that we haven't seen in, 150,000 years. The Australians are more worried about our world contaminating the pristine world of that lake headspace. So caution has to be taken both ways. This probe that they send down on the end of the cable, it'll be a 5 meter long probe. It's about 16 feet. Will then be lowered through the hole and into the lake carrying 24 flasks that will gather water samples at various depths. It will also carry lights and a high definition video camera and filters to draw solids from the water. Much of the equipment has been designed and built by the National Oceanography Center in Southampton under the supervision of Matt Molern. This is an unknown environment. We don't know, for example, whether there will be dissolved gases in the water. So the water at its pressure of 300 atmospheres will be sampled. But when we pull the probe up and the flasks hit the cold air, in the borehole, the water will try to freeze. The pressure then increases to around 2,700 atmospheres, and that's greater than anything experienced in ocean engineering. Once the probe has been hauled up, a coring device will be lowered down the borehole to take samples of the lake floor sediment. It's going to be interesting to see how they hold 300 atmospheres back while they're doing all this. Got to have some kind of seal there. You can't just have a 12-inch open hole to the atmosphere. It'll be like a jet coming up out of the ground. Hopefully there's not a lot of methane in it, because that would be quite flammable. And a gas-fired boiler at the surface could mean a well fire. Seen one happen before. It's not a good thing. It will melt the rig to the ground. It comes out of there at extremely high temperatures. So we don't really know what's going to happen when they make first contact. It's going to be very interesting. This is the year when it's going to happen. We're not really sure, what effect it's going to have. We do know these are two completely different worlds. Ostensibly, this is a lake that existed before humans were on the Earth. But if you listen to our good friend Kevin Smith and our good friend Michael Cremo, we've been around a lot longer than the anthropologists would have you believe. So It's an interesting story, this scientific exploration at the Antarctica. It's conditions that would be, I think, a lot of fun myself. They give you the proper clothing. Of course, you know, 70-mile-an-hour winds across an ice field all day long, every day, having to, you know, I hear the heating bills are not too bad in the summertime down there, but in the wintertime it can be brutal. Your first mistake is your last when you're outside at 90 below zero and the wind's blowing 70 miles an hour. And when it's blowing like that, you're not going to see a relief plane landing anytime soon, so you have to make it on your own. And if you don't know how to rub two sticks together to make fire, you could be in a real trouble. Any of you have comments on that? I would love to hear about it. Don't forget, coming up in December, we have the Pythagoras Conference. Go to the Pythagoras Conference link at xsquaredradio.com. It is the blue banner on the right-hand side. It is within driving distance of almost everywhere in the United States. It sits smack dab in the middle of 73% of the population. We just have never had a paranormal scientific conference in the Midwest. They're always out on the West Coast. And if you want to go, well, you got to buy a $500 plane ticket. You got, you know, 3 days in a $100 hotel. You got meals. You got all that stuff, but this is within driving distance. It doesn't matter if you live in Chicago, Atlanta, New York. You can drive to Louisville. It's within driving distance. You don't have to spend a lot of money on a plane ticket. Sandra Sabatini and her team have put together what I think is one of the best conferences that have been in the Midwest in, I don't know, maybe forever. 20 of the top speakers out there, Michael Cremo, Ed Close, myself, not that I'm bragging on myself, but I think that we've put together what could be one of the best conferences ever, and it's within driving distance. And it's at the Galt House, for crying out loud. If you've ever been to the Galt House in Louisville, this is the finest hotel right there on the river. It's affordable. It's 2-for-1. Click on the banner at X Squared Radio and get yourselves down there. I'd love to see you in December. All right, let's go to the phones again. Scott from Daytona, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Brooks. I was a little bit late getting on tonight. I was in Barnes & Noble. I found a copy of Forbidden Archaeology. It's $44.95. It's quite a price, but probably well worth it. Michael Cremo will also be in Arkansas November 11, that weekend, with a few other people. The name of the conference, I can't remember. I saw it advertised in Sedona magazine a few days ago. It's been this month's copy of Sedona.
That's the Ozark Conference. Yeah, that's a great conference.
Okay, I just wanted to throw that out. I also wanted to add that I have to take magnesium more than calcium for my system because that's kind of like I get Charlie horses if I get too much calcium in my diet. But I have to take magnesium and boron, and it would be an inconvenience for me to go to the doctor and ask for a script for magnesium if I had to do that. So, yes, we need to have the right to go to the health food store and make choices on our own. Kinesiology is also very helpful in figuring out what each person needs if they can learn that skill or meditation some way, learn what's right for their bodies, and then go about finding the right foods to eat, the right vitamins to take, the right supplements, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, do you think that there is, like, you know, open, you know, process of elimination or competition between the holistic practitioners like chiropractors and yoga practitioners and the pharmaceutical industries?
Right now, I think I think the pharmaceutical might consider the other to be a threat. And that's probably why things are as they are. But, you know, when I go into the chiropractor's offices, I see natural supplements being offered when I go to the chiropractor. And with that, the doctors, I think they're becoming more, they are starting to open up. My physician, when I see him, you know, he's a bodybuilder, and, you know, he's into organic, and he's an exceptional doctor. And he takes supplements, I'm sure, and so on and so forth. And they do ask you that, you know, when you go to a physical checkup now, you know, what's any supplements you're taking, et cetera, et cetera. So I think they pretty much, they're starting to accept that people are going to go ahead and do it. They're going to go ahead and use them, and what are they taking? And are they taking vitamin E? Are they taking vitamin C? You know, that sort of thing. I also take flaxseed oil because I think that's good for the omega-3s. You know, everyone's different. Some people will respond better to cod liver oil or salmon oil, and some for hemp oil. But being in the healthcare profession, you know, I'd love to take hemp, but we get UAID, and urine analysis, and that doesn't work because we don't know if we're going to show up THC positive or not if we're taking a hemp product.
That's right. And, you know, it's not so much the medical profession. I don't think doctors are really the driving force behind this. The reason we brought it up tonight is because I, you know, saw this article that, you know, vitamins are killing women over 50. And then on MSNBC and CNN and Fox News and, you know, local news, I'm hearing this almost like faxed talking points coming out over and over and over again that vitamins are bad for you. You should stay away from them. Don't take them unless your doctor tells you to. I think this is nuts.
Yes, people are far too unhealthy for that. I mean, with most of the grocery, I went to hear one of the speakers for Terry Naturally. It's a company that is promoting curcumin and turmeric. The curcumin is the root of turmeric. And they were talking about how grocery stores have expanded big times, but it's not because we have more food that's been created on this planet. No, with more junk food has been created on this planet, where most of what's sold in grocery stores, aside from produce, vegetables, and milk and eggs, is junk.
Yeah, it's all prepared food. It's in a box. It's in a can. It's, you know, everything. You just add water or don't add water. Just open it, boil it, and eat it. But as far as produce, you know, broccoli, cabbage, you know, carrots, potatoes, you know, people don't buy that stuff as much. They buy the junk.
Mm-hmm. And it's dehydrated, and it's had vitamins taken out, the vitamins put back in. And, it, you know, that's, I think a lot of what we see also is not, people don't eat balance. Like, I just went to a gathering for a friend who died, a therapist friend who passed away, and you know, there was a whole table of desserts. There was, you know, like a whole table of protein, but there's nothing to balance any of that with except coleslaw. And, you know, what do people, you know, people normally eat that way. I mean, do they eat enough greens to balance the acid? It's like it's all about balance between protein and the acid and protein and the alkaline and the vegetable. And to keep that in mind, almost every time I eat, I think of those terms, where I'll go to the Osterizer and I'll put in spring greens and put water in and then some peanut butter and blend it up, and that's a whole meal for me. You know, I'm getting the amino acid, I'm getting the balance of the vegetable, or I'll throw in, instead of peanut butter, I'll throw in cashews, organic whole raw cashews, or Brazil nuts. I use those today. So I'm getting the balance that way, and that tends to work a lot of magic in and of itself. I mean, the organic raw greens, provided they really are organic, do have a lot of A and C in them.
Oh, yeah.
And living in Florida, I have the benefit of D because every time I go out, most days are sunny, I'm getting D.
Sure.
Even in the winter. So, you know, that's one of the advantages of living here, even though we may be underwater soon. Well, I'll let you go, Dr. Brooks.
All right. I appreciate the call, Scott.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, there you have it. Another proponent of vitamins and balance and exercise and yoga. These are the kinds of things that keep us, you know, as a whole body growing. And I caution you. I mean, I'm not an alarmist or anything, but when I got to tell you, when I see the television advertisements one after the other after the other, it's Boliva, it's Lipitor, it's, you know, this, it's that, and they're just treating symptoms. And then they have a lot of side effects, which are just, they don't sound good. I mean, you know, dry mouth, upset stomach, you know, ulcers, you know, loss of vision, thoughts of suicide. I mean, come on. You know, when did you ever get that from eating broccoli? You don't. When did you ever get that from taking a multivitamin or, you know, B6 or a niacin, you know, something to help? There's a vitamin for everything, and I encourage you to, you know, talk to a chiropractor. They're usually really good holistic physicians. I would also talk to your local health food store. Start out small. I would encourage you to incorporate that into your diet just a little bit at a time, and you'll see that you'll have more stamina. You'll sleep better at night. You'll have less parasites in your system. You'll have a healthy colon. You'll have a healthy prostate. The things that we ingest when we eat fast foods, when we eat pre-prepared foods, it just can tear you apart. A lot of that stuff goes through your system undigested, not good for you. So just, you know, everything in moderation, okay? It's not like you have to go through life only listening to what the pharmaceutical ads on the TV are telling you. There's just a way to do it. There's a way to figure it out. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll listen to a little of David Acton here, and we'll be back in about 3.5 minutes. Don't go away. We'll come back with more X-Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Welcome to the third hour of X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Somebody asked me the other day what I thought the secret to world peace was. Of course, I instantly said chocolate. Absolutely chocolate. But I also spoke to a friend today who said, you know what I love? I love Christmas movies. I just get the best feeling when I see the Christmas movies and hear the music and just think about giving and caring for one another. And I think that's a pretty good prescription. Watched part of Santa Claus 2. Just like it. You're feeling down and out, feeling like the world's beat you up, or you're unemployed, or you think you need to get back on top, I recommend a Christmas movie. Just step out for a little while and get some peace and good cheer in your life. All right. I asked Congressman Ron Paul to come on the program, and although he is not here in person tonight, I did pick up something that that he's been talking about, and it's current. As you know, we talked about the drone killing drones here, and there's been no shortage of remote surveillance, and now remote attack vehicles out there, sort of like Cyberdyne systems with a joystick behind it. Young airmen in Nevada flying aircraft in Afghanistan and even countries with whom we are not at war. Congressman Paul wrote a piece called The Outrageous Death of Law. And I want to start this hour talking about it. I've also asked Herman Cain to be on the program. We're still waiting for an answer. It hasn't been that long. He realizes that we have a far-reaching program. He also realizes that he is not, spending the money that the other primary participants will spend to win this nomination. But nevertheless, Herman Cain has, at least as far as the press is concerned, has become the number one choice, according to Rasmussen. I don't count out Congressman Paul because he does have many, many decades of private practice. He does have over a decade in public office, and he has never changed his story. And now it's more like the public is coming around to realizing he was right. But I'm going to read you this piece. You might get a little bit outraged. Maybe that's the purpose of it. I'm going to add a little bit of sanity to it as we go along, but here we go. According to the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, Americans are never to be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The Constitution is not some aspirational statement of values allowing exceptions when convenient, but rather it is the law of the land. It is the basis of our republic and our principal bulwark against tyranny. It has worked for us for well over 200 years. Last week's assassination of two American citizens, and we've talked about this on this program, this is Ron Paul's perspective of this slippery slope. Last week's assassination of two American citizens, Anwar al-Awlaki and Samir Khan, which is their Arab names. I don't know what their real names were. It could be Bob Smith and Joe Gibbs, for all I know, is an outrage and a criminal act carried out by the president and his administration. That's a very direct accusation. If the law protecting us against government-sanctioned assassination can be voided when there is a, quote, really bad American, is there any meaning left to the rule of law in the United States? If, as we learned last week, a secret government committee, not subject to the congressional oversight or judicial review, can now target certain Americans for assassination, under what moral authority do we presume to lecture the rest of the world about protecting human rights? didn't we just bomb Libya into oblivion under the auspices of protecting the civilians from being targeted by their government? Timothy McVeigh was certainly a threat, as were Nidal Hassan and Jared Lee Lawner. They killed people in front of many witnesses. They took up arms against their government in a literal way. Yet, we're still afforded trials. These constitutional protections are in place because our founders realized it is a very serious matter to deprive any individual of life or liberty. Our outrage against even the obviously guilty is not worth the sacrifice of the rule of law. Al-Awlaki has been outspoken against the United States, and we are told he encouraged violence against Americans. We do not know that he actually committed any acts of violence. Ironically, he was once invited to the Pentagon as part of an outreach to modern Muslims after 9/11. As the U.S. attacks against Muslims in the Middle East and Central Asia expanded, it is said that he became more fervent and radical in his opposition to U.S. foreign policy. Many, even in the press, cheer this killing because they believe that in a time of war, due process is not necessary, not even for citizens, and especially not for those overseas. However, there has been no formal declaration of war, and certainly not one against Yemen. The post 9/11 authorization for force would not have covered these two Americans because no one is claiming they had any connection to that attack. Al-Awlaki was on a kill list compiled by a secret panel within President Obama's National Security Council and Justice Department. How many more American citizens are on that list? They won't tell us. What are the criteria? They won't tell us. Where is the evidence? They won't tell us. Al-Awlaki's father tried desperately to get the administration to at least allow his son to have legal representation to challenge the kill order. He was denied. Rather than give him his day in court, the administration behind closed doors served as prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner. The most worrisome aspect of this is that any new powers this administration accrues will serve as precedents for future administrations, including this one. Even those who completely trust this administration must understand that if this usurpation of power and denial of due process is allowed to stand, these powers will remain to be expanded on by the next administration and then the next. Will you trust them? History shows that once a population gives up its rights, they are not easily won back. Ron Paul goes on to say, beware. Now, I would like to know your thoughts on this. I know some of you have said, oh, come on, Al-Awlaki was a bad guy. I've heard it in the press. I've heard it on Bill O'Reilly said, what, are you a moron? The guy was a bad guy. He was fighting against us. I'm not buying it. I'm spinning my pin here in the air the way he does. I'm sorry. We don't go out and target people with robots in countries in which we have not committed war. We don't have the permission to fly over them, and we don't kill American citizens. We just don't. We arrest them. We bring them back, and we put them on trial. Now, the memo that we read part of last week talks about how Obama came to this legal opinion and him and his kill squad. And by the way, these have existed before, you know, in other organizations. Oh, yes, absolutely. They existed. Not as part of this country, of course, because we've always held, since the Constitution was first formed, and we have signed that treaty over and over again in subsequent presidents. We will not assassinate leaders of other countries. We will not use assassination as a tool. That being said, it's kind of hard to resist the logic behind assassinating someone like Hitler before the war ever starts. But I'm telling you, once we start down that road, no leader is safe. No diplomat is safe. We'll have ambassadors murdered next. We'll have senators and congressmen targeted. It goes on and on and on. Now, the really scary part is that now Saudi Arabia believes that this plot to kill the Saudi Arabian ambassador to the United States while he was in the United States is an act of war by Iran. And Iran is denying that they had anything to do with it, and we don't know who to believe. But this is how it goes, people. This is how it gets escalated. And by the way, we knew about this back in June. It's just terrible that it makes the press in September. They always hold these things so they have particular timing in the press, it seems. But here we are on this slippery slope. We are now targeting American citizens in other countries, and there's no proof whatsoever that either of these individuals committed any violence. Oh, they might have preached. They might have talked. They might have been enemies of the state from a state point of view. But to go and assassinate them in another country? Well, it's interesting. Okay, I have a text here. Let me see if I can read this. This actually comes from Canada, British Columbia. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution explicitly declares that no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Aulaki, who was not a member of the U.S. Armed Forces, was not afforded these rights. The assassination was both illegal and unconstitutional. You're exactly correct, sir. Absolutely correct. That is Ted from British Columbia. He was not a combatant. He was not a uniformed soldier. And he was not in the Navy. It wasn't in the militia. And he was not doing any of those things that was listed in the Constitution. So this guy was way down the list of priorities, I think, as far as bad guys to go after. And I think this was just a test of the legality. So now we let this one go. We say, okay, well, we wrote this memo and we popped these two American citizens in Yemen. And we got away with it, guys. We got away with it. No revolution here. No pitchforks out front. We successfully arrested the lemonade stand girls. They're serving 3 months in jail. Oh, I'm sorry. By the way, the girls refused to give urine samples, so they're actually serving 6 months in jail for selling lemonade in front of the Capitol building. Yeah, we now have the rule of law working very, very well. We have a push-button assassination squad that we can operate out of Nevada. It's complete hands-off. It's totally depersonalized. And now this really makes our enemies shake in their boots because we can get them anytime, anywhere, in any country, whether or not they are an American citizen or not. Well, that's my take on it. I don't know. I'm giving Ron Paul his shot here, and I think he's correct in his judgment here. Now, I don't know if they're going to call for the impeachment of Obama. I think it would just be a waste of assets. I think this is just more sand in the balance that tips it away from an Obama second term. I hate to see it because I think on the surface, at least from what I heard in my industry, he started to do some good. But on the other hand, maybe small business was used as a banner of get you behind enemy lines, so to speak, so that you can do this kind of damage. This is very, very dangerous activity for a country to participate in. The sad thing is we probably have been doing this for a while. You know, little one-car accidents, little plane crashes here and there, but we never took credit for it. We never went to the news and said, I authorized the assassination of these two American citizens because they're bad guys. We never did that before. We may have done it, but we swept it under the carpet. We said, well, that's unconfirmed. Well, it might have been pilot error. Oh, isn't that sad that cars aren't as safe as they're supposed to be, that they'll just leave the road at 90 miles an hour and smack into a tree all on their own? Isn't it sad that a car will have an accident in a tunnel and slam into a pylon or something? And it's just unfortunate, you know. It's just a coincidence that they were outspoken critics of the leadership. But, it's a sad thing that these things, it's just, we hope it doesn't happen to us. We hope it doesn't happen again. We were really looking forward to working this out diplomatically. I don't think so, people. I think we have become like Israel. We just pop a drone in the air, put the crosshairs on him, take him out with as little collateral damage as possible, and we claim it. We did it. Our own citizens are not safe from us now, so let's go after anybody we want. You got another idea on this or support of it? 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. Anywhere on planet or off planet, you support or don't agree with Congressman Paul's position on this, 530-413-4511. It is not politics we're talking about. It is the science of law. The Constitution is a document that is probably a second-generation document. The Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights, notably coming from the Magna Carta, signed in 1215, when several Scots, including possibly one of my ancestors, the Ross on that roster, was a Scotsman, forcing King John to sign the Magna Carta, trying to redress grievances and establish inalienable rights to the people. And we see the language again surface in more clarity and more depth in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. The first 10 amendments as the Bill of Rights, and since that time we've had 17 amendments, not all of which have been good in my opinion. Some of them could probably be repealed. The 16th and 17th Amendments could certainly be repealed. By the way, he goes on, my text support in British Columbia, Ted, says, the corrupt usurpers of America believe they are above the law and retribution. They believe they can get away with any crime as long as the American people are kept in a state of ignorance. I don't know that we're in a state of ignorance, Ted. I think we're in a state of apathy. We know that the administration committed cold-blooded murder. We know that assassination is murder. We know that the airmen who were in Nevada that flew the drone that killed these two American citizens are innocent because they were following orders of their commander-in-chief. We are not ignorant. We know exactly what happened. We know exactly what law was broken. Our congressmen, including Ron Paul, are stating it. But we are in a state of apathy. We have given up so many of our liberties in exchange for safety. Just as Ben Franklin once predicted, we have given up our liberties to have safety until we have none. The very laws that guaranteed life to those American citizens was thrown out the window to test a drone assassination system in a foreign country. You think the Yemenis are saying anything about it? No. Do you think the Iranians are saying anything about it? Yes. Shortly after this assassination, it came to light that they had an assassination plot against a Saudi Arabian ambassador in this country. Does that mean that that's when they did it? Nope. The administration was aware of it and had been briefed of it all the way back in June. But they didn't tell us about it. Nope. They handled it just the way they do all the other threats. But because it was tit for tat, because we had assassinated someone in a foreign country, it was time to release the news that they were trying to assassinate someone in our country. As if that doesn't go on every day, we just don't hear about it. Little one-car accidents, little slip in the bathtub, little heart attack here and there. You know, he had high blood pressure. He was a known alcoholic, blah, blah, blah. They die all the time, but we never take credit for it. This time we have a president that takes credit for it. And it's a little disconcerting. I don't know what to make of it. I'm studying it myself, and I'm asking for your opinions. 888-429-5471, 530-413-4511. More in the news here. Let's step away from that just a little bit because I know the phones are trying to light up, but I don't want to make this into a political show. I don't want to. I just want you to stay aware. I want you to stay informed and be empowered and realize that, you know, one after the other, the things that we have fought for, the things that we memorialize with our troops, the things that we hold to be dear, that we salute in the flag, that we have some patriotism for, are being stripped away from us. They're being handed back to us. Once a nice, clean, white linen made pure by truth, made pure by the endowment from God, are now soiled with the blood of murder. This is not acceptable. It is not acceptable. All right, let's talk about a little bit about global warming. We call it climate change now. Climate skeptics are winning the battle. Yes, absolutely. Climate skeptics are winning the battle. Which battle is that? You mean that the Earth is no longer changing? No, not that battle. They're winning the battle of the press. Father of the Green Movement says scientists lack PR skills to make the public listen. He's right. He's right. Half of engineering is engineering, and the other half is marketing, public relations. If you're not good at it, you're going to get swallowed alive in this quick, lithium battery lighted world that we're in. As long as the battery holds up, why, that's the story of the day. But as soon as the battery gets popped in the recharger, I'm sorry, people just don't pay any attention to the story again. But they can't help but listen, because there are some pretty powerful things to note relative to climate change. Climate skeptics are winning the argument with the public over global warming. The world's most celebrated climate scientist, James Hansen of NASA, said in London yesterday, "It is happening, even though climate science itself is becoming even clearer in showing that the Earth is in increasing danger from rising temperatures," said Dr. Hansen, who leads NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies and is widely thought of as the father of global warming. His dramatic alert about climate change in U.S. Senate hearings in July 1988 put the issue on the world agenda. He was correct in 1988. He would have been correct in 1997. But in 1998, the temperatures stopped rising. They leveled out. That is to say, the average temperature leveled out. the extreme cold and extreme heat of winter and summer, that became wildly separated. Well over 100 degrees and more in most areas of the world. Over 100 degrees, now I think it's up to 103 degrees difference between the winter and the summer. Since then, he has been one of the most outspoken advocates of drastic climate action. And yesterday, he also publicly criticized Germany's recent decision to abandon its new nuclear power program, formerly a key part of German climate measures in the wake of the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan earlier this year. Look, that Fukushima disaster had a lot of exacerbating circumstances. Reactor number 4 did not have a containment over it. It had been taken off. There was no fuel in reactor number 4. It should not have exploded. There was nothing there to explode. That was a bomb that went off in reactor number 4. Reactor number 3 is leaking, but only because the containment was breached, not by a hydrogen explosion. It was built to handle that and more. That was breached by a bomb. It blew a hole in the side of the containment. We're talking 17 feet of reinforced concrete, people. Hydrogen doesn't blow through something like that. That containment was made to hold that. Then we had all of the auxiliary pumps that operate off the residual steam from the reactor. Guess what? They never got valved in. Why? Because the entire reactor complex had been infected by a computer virus that was designed by the Israelis and infected their machines. This virus specifically targets the cooling pumps. It makes it impossible to shut the reactor down once it goes into an overheating condition. That's what the virus does. That's why it was designed. And the big question is why? It's simple. So simple. Less than a year before, Japan had announced that they would enrich uranium and sell it to the Iranians. Japanese uranium was going to be enriched and sold to the Iranians for their nuclear program, and the Israelis simply took out the supply. It was simple. All right. So I don't know why Germany would not pursue its nuclear power program based on Fukushima. He goes on to say, I think it was a big mistake. I think the Prime Minister, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, knows that. As she's a physicist, but I think the political reality is she couldn't stay in office if she expressed that opinion. The public just wouldn't have it. In a briefing at the Royal Society, Dr. Hansen, pictured in this article, was frank about the success with public opinion of what he termed the climate contrarians in effectively lessening public concern about global warming. It's true. It's true. On the list of items of public concern, global warming ranks last. It didn't. It didn't always. It ranks last now. They have been winning the argument for several years, even though the science has become clearer. There's been a very strong campaign by those who want to continue fossil fuel business as usual, and the scientific story has not been powerful enough to offset that push. Part of the problem, he said, was that the climate skeptic lobby employed communications professionals whereby scientists are just barely competent at communicating with the public and don't have the wherewithal to do it. He's right. He's right. We didn't buy press releases. We didn't get out there and talk on the radio. We didn't get on the main talk shows and talk about proof and evidence, you know, the real hard stuff. Oh, no, no, no. We couldn't do that. But the naysayers, well funded by the petroleum industries, went out there and said, global warming is a lot of hooey. Climate change is a lot of hooey. Well, let me tell you something. Texas is going to burn for the next 20 years. It's going to snow in about a week or 10 days on the Wasatch Front on top of snow that did not melt from last winter. People, that's called a glacier. There has not been a glacier in the Wasatch Front for probably 20,000 years. It's back. We are experiencing climate change. These are exactly the symptoms of climate change. The result was, he said, that in recent years, a gap has opened between what is understood about global warming and the relevant scientific community and what's known by the people who need to know. And that's the public. That's you and me. However, there's nothing that has happened to reduce our scientific conclusion that we are pushing the system into a very dangerous territory. In fact, that conclusion has become stronger over the same time period. Asked if anything might be re-alert the public to the dangers of climate change, Dr. Hansen said, Mother Nature. Significant climate extreme events were now occurring over 10 to 15% of the planet annually, whereas between 1950 to 1980, they occurred over less than 1%. He adds, so in places like Texas this year, Moscow last year, and Europe in 2003, the climate change is so big that they are undeniable. He's right. It was 115 degrees in Los Angeles last year. It was 103 degrees in London. In London, are you kidding me? Within 10 to 15 years, they're going to occur over 15 to 20% of the planet. So people have to notice that the climate is changing. Now, I'm not saying that the world is heating up, but these extremes are undeniable. Texas, in the summer of 2011, 75% of the state is classified as an exceptional drought. Moscow, August of 2010, they had temperatures of 111 degrees. They lost 70% of their wheat crop. Northern Europe in 2003, 40,000 people died from temperatures in excess of 101 degrees. Iran failed with Space Monkey launch. Oh, you're going to love this story. I got to fit this one in here. We got about 20 minutes left in the program. If you want to give us a call, it's 888-429-5471. And anywhere on planet or off planet, it's 530-413-4511. Iran took their first space shot and they had a monkey in the capsule. You remember when we did that way back in the 60s. Iran acknowledged as a failure Wednesday its attempt to send a live monkey into space last month, touted as its first step toward launching a man into space. The Kavoshgar 5 rocket carried a capsule with a live animal, a monkey, was launched during Shah Rivar, an Iranian calendar month spanning August 23rd to September 22nd. However, the launch was not publicized as all of its anticipated objectives were not accomplished. Yeah, we don't want to tell people about the bad news. The reporter said, the launch of a live animal into space was strategic and a priority and expressed hope that future launches would attain more of the objectives set. On October 3rd, which would have been just about 2 weeks ago, Iran indefinitely postponed plans to send a live monkey into space without giving any reasons. One cannot give a set date for this progress. And as soon as our nation's scientists announce the readiness of the project, it will return, said Hamid Fazeleh, head of Iran's space organization. The project envisaged launching a capsule with life support using the Kavoshgar 5 rocket to an altitude of 120 kilometers, that's 75 miles, for a 20-minute suborbital flight. The project was unveiled in February by President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. At the time, Fazeli touted the launch of a large animal as the first step towards sending a man into space, which Tehran says it's scheduled for 2020. In mid-March, Iran announced the successful launch of an earlier version of the rocket, the Kavoshgar 4, carrying a test capsule designed to house the monkey. Iran has already sent small animals into space, a rat, turtles, worms, aboard a capsule carried by its Kavoshgar 3 rocket in 2010. The Islamic Republic, which first put a satellite into orbit in 2009, has outlined an ambitious space program amid Western concerns. The rocket technology may be linked to developing ballistic missiles that could deliver nuclear warheads. You think? Tehran has repeatedly denied that its nuclear and scientific programs mask military ambitions. I don't know. I believe them. I give them the benefit of the doubt. How can we trust a country that would target its own citizens for assassination? Doesn't make any sense to me. Oh, and one more thing. I just... this is an interesting article that was sent to me by a friend. You know, electric vehicles have been around for a long time. And one has to ask the question, why haven't electric vehicles really taken off? Well, they did. They did for a long time. You remember in Chicago and New York, all the buses and the L's and everything were all electric. They still are. All those trains, all those subways in D.C., New York, Chicago, they're all electric. That is the cheapest way to move people around any city. But long before the Wright brothers flew, long before the Model T came out, there was the Roberts electric car. Built in 1896, it still gets to this day a solid 40 miles to the charge, exactly the mileage Chevrolet advertisers for the Volt, the much-touted $31,645 electric car. By the way, I challenge you to buy one for that. The last one I saw was $47,000 for a Chevy Volt. The executives at Chevrolet can rest easy for now, since the Roberts was constructed in an age before Henry Ford's mass production. The 115-year-old electric car is a one-of-a-kind. But don't let the car's 115 years let you think it isn't tough. Its present-day owner, who prefers not to be named, told the Daily Caller, that's a newspaper, it still runs like a charm and has even completed the roughly 60-mile London to Brighton vintage car race. It still has its original motor. If you didn't know there are electric cars as old as the Roberts, you aren't alone. Prior to today's battle of electric versus gas, and let me tell you, people, it's a battle. There was another battle, electric versus gas versus steam. This contest was fought in the marketplace, and history shows gas gave electric and steam an even more thorough whooping than Coca-Cola gave Moxie. Oh, yeah. And that's because the money was behind the gas. But while the Roberts, and because here's the thing, who was going to charge you to drive your electric car? That's right. Nobody. You'd pay for it with your own electric bill. Well, the petroleum industry couldn't allow that. In fact, there's one more they forgot here. It was electric versus gas versus steam versus alcohol. Versus vegetable oil. That's right. Rudolf Diesel in 1912 didn't invent that engine to run off petroleum diesel. He invented it to run on vegetable oil, and it ran very well. Very powerful high-torque engine that we still use today. We still call it the diesel. So how did the petroleum industry win? Simple. Outlaw the production of alcohol. That was easy. Just outlaw the production of alcohol, and then you have the only fuel. So while the Roberts electric car clearly lacked GPS, power steering, and, yes, airbags, The distance it could achieve on a charge when compared with its modern equivalent provides a telling example of the slow pace of the electric car. And that's not necessarily market-driven. We've made full circle on this, people. People are really, the public is really tired of spending $3.30 to $3.50 a gallon for gasoline and $3.60 to $3.90 a gallon for diesel. Yeah, it's something to see. Now, in the news, we've got about 6 or 7 minutes left. I just can't pass this up. Who is occupying America? You know, by now you've heard all about it. Who are they? Do they make up the fabric of America? Why do these people hate all corporations? They seem to be protesting against economic inequality. What? What does that mean, economic inequality? Have-nots, people who have money and people who don't? Come on, that's been around since the dawn of time. Traditionally, what determines if you have money or you don't have money? Well, your ability to convert what you do into a contract to pay, which we also call money. That's it, period. For some, it's minimum wage. For others, it's a $50 million bonus check. Yeah, that's right. If you're the man who brings a $100 billion deal to the closing table, what should be your commission? Typically, it's about 1%. But that would mean a $1 billion commission. Not possible, people. They cap it at around $50 million. How many of those do you have to do in a lifetime to make a good living? Do you have any idea how hard it is? How long it takes to close a deal of that size? No, I suppose you don't. I know how hard it is to close a deal of a few million, and it's like having a baby every week. Could you do it? Oh, there's another way to make money. Instead of earning it, you raise it. That means you print money and sell it. Governments do it, and so does Wall Street. They make up shares, sell them with a ton of marketing and hype to people who are looking to get in low and sell high to others who are enamored by the hype of the stock. The last one caught holding the stock loses. So, these protesters have a similar theme in all cities where they hit the streets and parks speaking of their frustration about Wall Street. I just wanted to make sure you knew where the real cause of the problem is. Is it this ability to print worthless shares and trade them to raise money? Is this what the protesters hate? I'll bet you a year's salary that if they could put together a few complete sentences and design a company that investors liked, they would walk out of that city park in 1 minute flat. So what do the protesters want? They want all the wealth of the country to be redistributed to the masses who did not earn it. That would make everyone in the nation poor. There'd be no wealth to create jobs. There'd be no loans, no grants, no foundations, no arts, no symphonies, no fast food, and no clothing to wear. There'd be no cars, no gas, no electricity, no movies to watch, no sports franchises to fill our weekends with entertainment. There'd be no colleges, no tap water, no malls, and no airlines. This must be what the protesters want. Let me tell you a little story about the Templars, the Freemasons. They are perhaps the first modern record of a bank being used to safekeep money. Pilgrims to the Holy Land of Israel would leave Europe with their treasures in hand and be robbed and killed along the way. Well, the Templars and the Freemasons stopped in and created the first checks. They stepped in and created the first checks. Sorry, my E was an O. Pilgrims would deposit their funds in France, let's say. Then they would hike on down to Israel, cashing checks along the way, based upon their deposit in their home bank. Did they have gold on them? No. They had a deposit slip that was encrypted. Only they could get money out of what? The bank? What money? Well, the deposited money. Now, The Freemasons amassed more wealth faster than anyone had done in history. And what value did they add? Well, hardly anything. It's called alchemy. They got the depositors' money, which was really the only value actually added into the system, and they skimmed a little off the top. And when Philip the Fair decided to make a huge haul, his armies moved on all the Freemason banks and seized everything. They got nothing. All the money was gone. Philip got nothing. Where was the money? Where was the gold? Nowhere? Great question. The banks claim they have no money. The insurance companies claim they have no money. The people have no money. The government has been broke for 30 years. So who has the money? The answer is that there never was any money. It was a wave of value that moved through the system from one end to the other. And there was skimming going on at every turn, handling charges, I guess. But there never was such a thing as money. It's paper. It's imbued with Freemason symbolism to instill confidence of the people, to trust it. The question is, do we trust it? And what's going on with the people of Wall Street, the people that are occupying all of these parks? What's going on? Let's see how the president is answering questions about it, how he parries who they are and who he shall align with. Listen to this.
As you travel the country, you also take credit for tightening regulations on Wall Street through the Dodd-Frank law and about your efforts to combat income inequality. There's this movement, Occupy Wall Street, right, which has spread from Wall Street to other cities. They clearly don't think that you or Republicans have done enough, that you're in fact part of the problem. Are you following this movement, and what would you say to its people that are attracted to it?
Obviously, I've heard of it. I've seen it on television. I think it expresses the frustrations that the American people feel, that we had the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression, huge collateral damage all throughout the country, all across Main Street, and yet you're still seeing some of the same folks who acted irresponsibly trying to fight efforts to crack down on abusive practices that got us into this problem in the first place. So, yes, I think people are frustrated, and you know, the protesters are giving voice to a more broad-based frustration about how our financial system works.
As you travel
all right,
the country, you...
All right, so that's basically his take on it. Now, you know, on the ground in this, there is another take. There is the, you know, who's keeping all this going? Where are all these people getting their ideas? How is it that they're getting their talking points? Who's having them show up? Who's providing the meals? Who's keeping all this, you know, together as you go? Well, it's kind of interesting. I'm going to play you this part, and I think you're going to find it very interesting. It's a short interview. This is a lady on the street at the park who has been there since day one. I want you to listen to this interview very carefully.
The occupation here at Occupy Wall Street is in its third week. You've heard that a lot. It sort of sounds like a good tagline. The reality is it has been more than 3 weeks that people have been here day in, day out. Can you imagine what that actually involves? A lot. With me is Nalini. She's been here since day one, and she's part of the organizing team and the outreach team that has managed to bridge the distance between that first day and this day, and between the grassroots folks here and the labor movement. It's all paying off today. Could be a turning point day as labor and community organizations march and declare their support of what's happening here at Occupy Wall Street. Nalini, you must be feeling pretty darn pleased with yourself, and you have a right to.
Well, I'm so glad of, I'm proud of everyone because everyone is outreach here and everyone has done an incredible job of, you know, bridging the gaps between different communities all over New York and, you know, also all over the occupations across the country. So today's going to be a great day.
Finally, some occupations we can believe in. Who are you? Are you some kind of trained organizer, activist, done this your whole life?
For the last couple of years, I've been working with the Working Families Party as an organizer.
All right, she's been working with Working Families as an organizer.
Tell me a bit about the process.
Keep
we'll
going.
Probably see some of it as we walk around. The General Assemblies, what are they?
General Assemblies is a chance to for everyone to kind of report back on working groups, make some announcements about things that are going on, points of information, and also pass agenda items. So, you know, we have proposals that are put on by working groups. You know, working groups are autonomous. They report back to the General Assembly, and as a General Assembly, we get to decide if it's something that's really extremely pertinent or has to do with our security and ethical reasons. We decide on proposals together and come to consensus on issues.
So it sounds like a very well-organized
team. Let's talk about the
team.
Issues and what you hope to change. If you had everything you wanted to come of this, what would that look like? I mean, if you, beyond surviving, beyond being here 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, if even half, say, of the changes you want in the world came about after this, what would that look like? What's your vision that keeps you going?
Well, it's hard to say, you know, my particular vision because I do believe in collective vision and collective because we're all living together in this society. But I do, you know, personally as, you know, an individual, I feel that, you know, having people not living paycheck to paycheck and really kind of changing the infrastructure of our system because it hasn't worked for us and really questioning, I mean, I know people have been questioning it, but saying and actually trying to change the capitalist system that we have today because it's not working for any of us and just really begin that conversation. And it started to begin, but and it's going to grow of how do we really reform and bring, you know, sort of revolutionary change to the states and how do we actually, you know, move forward from there. So if that comes out of this, that is a great starting point as well.
So revolution is on their mind.
As far as, you know, the importance of labor joining, it's huge. I mean, labor is under complete and utter attacks these days from corporate America and from, you know, the management aspect of things. And to have them, these folks who shut down New York City back in the 20s and in the 30s, to have them really joining this, you know, new age radical movement is really awesome to see because we want to get them back to their roots as well.
And the community organizations?
Yeah, same thing as well. You know, community organizations are they've been fighting for this stuff for years, and it's great that we can all join under this one overarching topic that it's like corporate greed, and it goes on to so many of what community organizations work on that is in itself a beautiful thing to just see it all kind of merge together. It's just, you know, the pieces of the puzzle are coming together.
The pieces of the puzzle are coming together. The enthusiasm about Occupy Wall Street is spreading out. At last count, how many occupations do you think are happening around the country? And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but a ballpark idea?
Around the country, I would believe there's like 29 to 32. I'm going to ballpark that that figure. Around the world, there's about 57 going on.
Thanks so much for joining us. We hope to stay in touch with you.
All right, so there you have it. So now we're hearing that kind of language, and I think that when we're talking about collective consciousness, we're talking about collective bargaining, we're talking about revolution, we're talking about the same kind of language that we hear from the White House. And by the way, wasn't Obama a community organizer before he became elected president? Just interesting stuff. Just thought I'd bring that up. I'm Brooks Agnew. This is X Squared Radio, and we'll see you next week right here on the BBS Radio Network. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.